This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
For years, I was so fed up with shampoo, I just stopped washing my hair. I quit completely. I was so sick of poofy, frizzy, limp hair, distorting my natural oils. Until a few months ago, I found Modern Mammals, and it changed everything. And by the way, right now you can visit modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. So check that out. So look, I heard about this through the podcast, and before I agreed to advertise, they sent it to me and I was reluctant. But let me tell you, I should not have been. This stuff is absolutely magical. My hair felt better, smelled way better, and most importantly, looked better. And I know it will do the same for you as well. It doesn't have those hair-ruining chemicals like other products, and it doesn't leave any leftover residues. It works. Don't believe me? Go read their awesome reviews online as well. Go to modernmammals.com and use code LSS for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code LSS. Don't forget to use our promo code LSS so they know we sent you. What is up, my sinners? It is Monday morning, January 16th, I'm going to say. I don't even know. You know what? It doesn't matter what day it is. It just doesn't matter. 2017 has just been so good so far. Are you guys having a good year? I'm having a great year. I'm down to 171 pounds. That's 5 pounds. I lost 5 pounds in 2 weeks. Perfect. I'm eating lots of salads. I've been making my own Thai soup, making some Vietnamese fresh rolls. It's been really, really awesome for me. I'm really enjoying my 2017. I hope you are so far as well. Welcome to Lead Singer Syndrome, a podcast where I talk to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a professional band. And this week, we have a great show. I have Max from the Arkells. And man, if you're American, you might not know the Arkells. You're going to, I think. I think you're going to know about them really soon. They're a Canadian band. They are from Hamilton, Ontario, which is only about 30 minutes from where I grew up. And up here in Canada, the Arkells are a big deal. They just headlined 2 sold-out seated shows at Massey Hall, which is a super, super iconic venue in Toronto. They've got at least 2 number one songs on the radio. They've been nominated and won Juno Awards, which is like the Canadian Grammys. So they are doing awesome. And Max is a super, super nice guy. This conversation is awesome. But they're on tour right now with Frank Turner in the U.S. That's how I hooked up with Max, actually. That's how I met Max. So please, if Frank and Max are coming through your hometown, be sure to pick up tickets. Do not miss that show because the Arkells are definitely a live band. I want to thank everybody who reached out to me last week after the Davey Muse episode. Wow, what a story that guy had. If you missed last week, please go back and check it out. I mean, we got like 60 back episodes. So yeah, go ahead. Go listen to them all. If you're just getting into the show now because you're Canadian and you love the Arkells, welcome. Great to have you along. Also, as I'm going to be plugging probably for the next forever, we have started the All Access Club. And how it works is for as little as $6 a month, you can join the All Access Club. You can be a part of this thing. You can help us keep the lights on. You can help this thing grow. And in return, you get a bunch of extra content, bonus episodes, a monthly Q&A with me. It was really fun, actually. We did our first one just a little while ago. Hung out and chat on there. I played a few songs. It was a lot of fun. Thanks to everybody who was there. You also get access to the very inexpensive Lead Singer Syndrome merch store, which is about to pop up. And of course, I send you a bunch of stuff in the mail, and the longer you're a part of the club, the more stuff you get. So all I ask is you go on the website, check it out, see if there's something right there for you. Don't worry, the show will always be free. So check out leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. Again, that is leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. Before we jump in, I want to remind you, I love to hear from you guys. I love to hear the feedback, positive, negative, neutral, whatever it is. So please get in touch. Again, Twitter is at Lead Singer Syn, S-Y-N. Instagram, we're at Lead Singer Syndrome. And of course, good old-fashioned email, is leadsingersyndrome at gmail.com. Thanks again for listening to this. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Max Kerman of the Arkells. You call me up from a payphone. I said, hang tight, I can drive you home. I pulled on up and with the southern accent, I offered you my dad's leather jacket. When times were tough in the worst years, you never knew how to interfere. And now
hello.
There he is.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. Just hanging out at home. Where are you right now?
I am also at home.
Nice.
Which is probably not too far from your home.
Are you in Liberty Village, though, or are you in Burlington?
I am currently at my parents' house in Oakville, actually.
Oh, okay, cool. Right there.
No, I grew up here in Oakville. And, I lived in Toronto for, like 6 years.
Okay.
And yeah, Liberty Village was my stomping grounds for a time. And now I'm just sort of like, I'm kind of in a weird place. I'm like doing some Airbnbs here and there. All my stuff's in storage. I'm kind of roaming around. So it's been fun. It's been different.
Well, if you're not a hoarder and you can pack light, you can do that pretty easily these days. As long as you got your laptop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Like I tell people this. And some people look at me like I'm out absolutely fucking crazy, but they'll just say like, I could never do that. And the fact is, I totally understand how people couldn't do that. But for me and for you, like we've been living out of a suitcase for like the last better part of a decade.
Totally.
So we're used to it. You know, I'm like, yeah, shit. I'm used to being in like a different hotel room every night. So a different like Airbnb every couple of weeks is like, for me, is like actually more luxurious.
I know. Yeah, you know, don't get me wrong, I like sleeping in my own bed, but when people are like, I really just need a night in my own bed, I kind of like don't identify with that so much. I'm just like, okay, yeah, I guess it's nice, but I'm whatever. I could sleep, you know, on a couch or in a hotel or Airbnb or wherever.
Yeah, no, it's for me, I think like more so than the bed is the shower. Like my own shower, it's just like it speaks to my soul. You know,
there you go. You must have a nice shower. My shower at home is like not even that great. So you're in a nice hotel and it's a nice shower, I'm like, oh, I could live here.
Oh, right. No, but I'm not talking really about hotel showers as much as like, you know, like a dirty venue shower in like Hungary or something. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Oh. Like, we could go on about European hotels and like, you know, Europeans, because of the size of, you know, the countries and how many people live in them, like are pretty used to having to like share close quarters, I feel like, compared to like big fat American beds and big fat American hotels.
Absolutely.
And hallways. But when you go to like a little, like Ibis hotel chain, oh man, those like they manage to pack like three beds and a bathroom and a shower within like 20 square feet. It's crazy. I know.
It's funny. Japan's like that too.
Oh, we've never been.
Yeah, oh, you've never been to Japan. That's crazy. I can't believe that.
No.
Oh, you guys.
Never been.
You guys got to go. You guys got
to
go.
Well,
you must
like
have records out over there and stuff.
Yeah, somebody actually sent a photo of like one of our records, like in a record shop in Japan. So they exist over there. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so many places to tour in the world. You kind of got to prioritize a little bit. I don't know anybody in Japan screaming for us, so we'll stick to places that we're a little more familiar with, at least for the time being.
No, I get that. It's funny, actually. I think Frank Turner told me he'd never been to Japan either, which is funny.
Oh, really?
And that's how we are hooked up, right? I mean,
that's how
we met, through Frank.
At the after party when he was DJing at the Velvet.
Yeah.
Was it Velvet Underground? Is that what it was?
Exactly. Velvet Underground, which was hilarious because, you know, earlier that day, Frank hung out with Frank in his hotel room. And your show, which I want to talk all about the shows and everything, your shows were completely sold out. They couldn't even get me in, I guess because it's seated. It's
really?
Harder. Yeah, they couldn't even get me in. All the seats were filled. So So Frank's like, fuck, I can't get you in, but you know what, dude, come to the after party. So I brought like my, you know, my three buddies, whatever. And Frank got so drunk, he had to bail.
Really?
I don't know if I think he might have left already at that point, but he had to bail. And then my buddy just like was up there with Frank's computer, like just DJing. And all the kids that came were like, who's this guy? What's going on? And I guess like the laptop like fucked up. and just started making like weird sounds, and he didn't know what to do, so he just closed the laptop, turned it off, and the club turned the lights on, and that was the end of the night. And the end of the night, at, like, and it wasn't even that late. It was like maybe like 10 after 1.
Oh, that's so funny. You know, nothing like sobering up a nightclub by just turning on the house lights, you know, just like, yeah. Like get back to reality.
Yeah,
for a minute.
Man. Yeah, no, but he was saying that about Japan too, and it's interesting. You'd think just, you know, the spillover from, you know, being on whatever major labels kind of just pushing it around the world to their different distributors would kind of have some effect. But I mean, as you guys know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, you guys have this massive popularity in Canada, and I'm sure you get this question all the time, but it's like, what is it like to, you know, have huge popularity in Canada, where you have like number one singles and all this shit. And then you go to like, you know, Salt Lake City, Utah, and you're like, my friend saw you there. And he's like, yeah. And they're just like up there being like, yeah, what songs do you guys want to hear? And there's like less, and there's probably like, you know, less than 100 people there.
Oh, totally. Well, you know, we've never had the attitude that we're entitled to anything, period. So I think when you go in with that attitude, it keeps your head on straight because you're grateful for when anybody shows up, period. So,
sure.
And that's not being like falsely modest or anything. I think we've like probably 7 years ago exceeded anything that we ever thought we'd get, like with this band, in terms of like recognition or, you know, things like getting played on the radio or touring with bigger bands. Like those are all things we never would have been able to conceive of when we first started. So that's number one. And number two, I think the one of the things I love about being in a band is that, you know, a lot, the work you put in, like I like to believe that at least the work you put in is sort of representative of like what you get back from it. So like, yeah. We had never been to Salt Lake City, and as much as the internet helps connect people, and as much as the internet, you know, connects music scenes, like, you know, the punk scene or the, you know, NPR music community or whatever, that could be really helpful. There's no substitute for just going there. So,
yeah,
you know, we've never had the expectation that we should show up and for the first time we play Albuquerque that there should be 500 people there screaming our name. Like, we've never had that, you know what I mean? Because that just doesn't make sense. It's like, why would they? We never have been there. We haven't made friends with the local music community there. And, you know, I think that's a big part of growing the band. So, and we know that from experience, because the first time we ever played, you know, Thunder Bay, there was maybe less than 100 people there.
Sure.
But then if you deliver a good show and you make a genuine, authentic connection with the people at the show, then word will spread around. You know, people will be excited for the next time you go back. And that's how I think you grow a crowd in a really organic way. And if you're one of those bands that has like, you know, one in a million single that just like catches fire on the radio or is in a movie or something, and you can show up to town and there's 1,000 people waiting for you, then God bless you. That's amazing.
Yeah, but great. But that's great for that one show, or maybe that year, or maybe a year and a half. But then what happens?
But how
right?
sustainable?
That's,
yeah, how
that's
sustainable
the
is
worst,
it?
Man. Like, I, you know, people always say, like, right now, Silverstein, we have a song actually getting put in the radio. You know, a couple radio stations are like, yeah, we're going to play you. And that's really the first time we've had legitimate, you know, commercial radio play, like added, you know, like legit. And a lot of people are like, that's crazy. You guys never had that. And I'm like, thank fucking God we never had that. Like, the last thing I would want is to be like, you know, a Plain White Tee's Hey There, Delilah. No offense. They're my friends. Those guys are great. But do you know what I mean? You have that kind of song that explodes, and it's this huge thing that's outside of your realm. And it's too far away. You can't control it anymore. And you're putting your career out of your control. Like, you know, you guys have managed to kind of ride this line where you have these big songs and you're getting this mainstream attention, you know, congrats on all that. Yet
in
you
Canada,
still have, yeah, in Canada, right, in Canada. And you still have your, your fan base that's diehard. And I think part of it is, a few minutes ago, you used the word genuine. And that to me is something that when I think of your band really comes across. Is that something that's important to you?
Yeah. I mean, I think, I like to think that, like, and I know I just said this, but it's like, I'm really like ecstatic when people, you know, go out of their way to spend time with our music or spend money on coming to a show. And I definitely don't take that for granted. And I think, like, in part it's because, you know, I'm a pretty keen observer of other people, generally speaking. And I witnessed the way, you know, other bands interact with their fans. And I always admire the ones that are genuine and authentic, and that, you know, just talk to their fans like they're normal people and sure. like aren't up on some pedestal.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Frank's actually a really great example of that. Frank yeah, treats everybody sure the same. He treats everybody the same. And he doesn't take anything for granted, because for him, it's the same. It's been similar. It's like, it's been a slow growth. It's not like he came out of the gate like with a number one song. You know, he started touring America in 2007.
Yeah.
And like, and everybody that we met on the American dates says, oh, you know, the first time I saw Frank Turner, I saw him at like a beer festival in Minnesota. And then the next time I saw him, he opened for Flogging Molly. And then the next time I saw him, I got to see him at an after party for Lollapalooza. And then the next time I saw him headline a little club. And so it's like all these little experiences that, that kind of will develop a fan's relationship with a band. And I think if there's something that seems like sincere about our band, it's because we've developed this rapport with our fans. It was like, oh, we saw you, you know, play My Frosh Week. And then I saw you at the Dakota Tavern. And then you hopped on stage with another band. And those are all just like little moments that can, you know, tie together.
Absolutely.
To create something meaningful. And yeah, you know, another guy who I love, who I really look up to, is Joel Plaskett. And he's like yeah. one of my favorite songwriters. And he's another guy who just treats everybody really well. Like, I like to think that if I've seen someone in the crowd at like four shows, there's a good chance I'll be like, oh, hey, I remember you. I saw you in Sault Ste. Marie, like, or yeah. like at least have some facial recognition. And that's not me being like a particularly like great guy. That's just me being a fucking human being. You know what I mean? yeah. And the other thing is, I'd say, is that we are very aware that not many musicians get to play their own songs and for a living, period, right? Like most
guys. I suppose, guys, yeah.
Well, think about it. It's like most musicians either have to play other people's songs or are, you know, session guys that kind of have to hop around from gig to gig and or have to work at a coffee shop or at a restaurant. The fact that, like, when it comes to actually, like, working full-time musicians that play your own songs that you can go out and sing your heart out and there's an audience singing back to you, that's actually, a pretty rare thing. I think a lot of people would love to have that job if it was easy. But it's not easy. It's super fucking hard. And I'm very aware of that this is, like, a very precious thing. And so we work really hard at it as a result. Like, you know, today, yeah. we've been home from tour for, you know, 3 weeks, and it's been a nice break. But like every morning I'm waking up and I have like a good routine where like I play piano for a while. I try to hack away on some lyrics and I send some emails and I think about what the tour poster in Vancouver should look like or whatever. And right. I really love it. Like it's, well,
that's
really
great.
I
mean, yeah. So you'd say you're a bit of a workaholic.
So, well, like similar to Frank, I'm definitely like a busybody. Like I don't do too well just sitting around.
Yeah. No, that's good. So you live in Hamilton, right?
Yeah, I live in Hamilton, downtown Hamilton. I grew up in Toronto, but I went to school at McMaster, so I just ended up staying here.
Well, let's start. You know what? Let's start from the beginning, because I don't know if you've had the chance to tell like really your whole story. And you know, I know you're a podcast guy too, which I love. Like,
yeah.
Like you're probably a bigger podcast fan than I am, and you probably know even more about the format than I do. And from what I understand, do you actually have your own podcast?
Yeah, so a friend. Yeah, I am obsessed with podcasts, and I listen to probably like 15 in rotation every week. And
wow,
I love the medium. You know, what, I can't even fall asleep without it anymore. If I'm like folding the laundry, or if I'm getting some exercise, or if I'm sure. going for a walk, I got my headphones down. But yeah, my friend Mike Bierman, who's a Hamilton guy, but he works at Bell Media. He's like kind of does creative ad writing and stuff.
Cool.
He and I have a podcast called The Mic on Much. He's the host of it, and we've interviewed. It's similar to this, you know. We interview yeah. people in the arts and in music, and I really just wanted to be a part of something. Something that's sort of outside of music, just to work another part of my brain. And it's a fun little side project just to be able to like develop something different and to be able to, cause I'm definitely like with the band stuff too, like a big picture guy. Like I'm not good at editing anything. I'm not particularly good with technology or, any of the nitty gritty work, but I do like thinking, okay, the show, you know, the open should last 7 minutes. Then the interview, let's listen to it and see what we can cut to make it as tight as possible. What are we going to do in the close? We have our friend Shane come on and he tells a funny story. And so just trying to develop something. And the other thing, about podcasts is that, like, you kind of got to build up a body of work for anybody to pay attention, because it's still a very niche genre. So a lot of my favorite podcasts, I didn't even hear about until they were 200 episodes in. So yeah. you got to trust that if you're putting out something good and you're developing a rapport with your listeners, they're going to tell their friends. And, you know, in a couple of years, you might be able to look back and go, oh, we got this thing and we got a real following and a community around the show. And that, I think that's a similar attitude that I have with the band.
Of course, these things take time. Everything takes time, and you can't expect everyone to find out about what you're doing like overnight, because there's just so much shit out there. That's, you know, that's the truth.
Well, but that's totally true. You know, I was talking about music videos with our manager the other day. I was just like, the hard thing about music videos is I don't really care about music videos right now in 2016, and in part it's because you spend a boatload of money, or you get a grant to spend a boatload of money. Yep. And it takes two or three days out of your life, and you're working away at a treatment, and you know, you come up with something that's like kind of cool and looks great and professional, because technology offers all that, and there's really talented people behind the scenes editing it and filming it, but you put it out on, you know, Twitter, and it kind of comes and goes in a day. And sure, it lives on YouTube, and that's a nice way for people to discover the song, but like, I think there is something to be said for like just generating, like, not just like a constant stream of content for the sake of content's sake, but just for like thinking about it in a very like holistic way, where it's like you need to not assume that one thing is going to move the needle. It's going to be a bunch of little things that are thoughtful and good that will help you move forward.
That's true. I think that's more the case now than ever. Yeah, it's totally true about music videos. That's really true about music videos. And like, so many of them we've done, they just kind of go, like, they just fall by the wayside. And I'm like, oh, shit, only this? Yeah, like, we did it. Okay, it was cool. Some people watched it then, yep, whatever. And I, like, there's videos we've done that I think I've watched, like, once. You know? And, like,
me too.
And I'll go back and watch them and be like, oh, yeah, that was kind of a cool shot, I guess. Like, but, like, you know, it is so funny. And the fear I have, you know, as a musician, and not only as a musician, but as a fan of music, is I hope that doesn't start happening with records, you know? And I think it's starting to, where something comes out and, oh, how many weeks ago did that come out? Well, whatever, on to the next thing. And it's like, damn, man, that's a scary thing, because, you know, Silverstein, we're a band, we've done like a 10-year anniversary tour of one of our albums. Like, that stood the test of time. And our records we're putting out now, are people going to care about them in 10 years, or are people not even going to remember them in 10 months?
Okay, well, you know what? If there's one bit of hope that I want to offer to you, is that what separates a band like Silverstein and Arkells versus, you know, a band that's not necessarily willing to put in the work, is that you guys are going to take those songs on the road from like a new record, and you're going to give an audience a relationship with each one of those songs in a live environment. So everywhere you go, there's going to be 1,000 people that's going to remember that song, like the new songs in your set, and then it's going to create a different meaning for them when they go home and listen to that record. And like, that's how you stretch things out. It's because you're right. If you just put out the song and never toured it, then people would come and go. But if you remain present in people's lives, whether, you know, maybe it's a little music video, then they hear the song on the radio, then they see you perform live, and then they go to a festival and you're there, and then you do a reunion tour, I think those things kind of add together to give hope for bands like us. Because I'd say this, the reason why I think Springsteen has, like, why people just revere him so much and have such a deep and special relationship is not necessarily solely based on the strength of those albums. It's because you've had a chance to see him over the years, over and over and over again. And those songs mean something different. Because when I saw him at the Sky Dome, he opened with a song off Born in the USA called Working on a Highway. And I never even really liked that song that much. But then I saw him come on stage with an acoustic guitar, and he was shaking his ass, and everybody was getting into it. And now I love that song. And it's because he went on the road and fucking owned it and made a memory for me. And if you're a band that can keep on making memories for people, like, based on that recorded material, I think it'll give life to.
It's true.
It's true. Songs.
You know, another thing that one of my favorite bands of all time, if not my favorite band of all time, is NOFX, the punk band.
And they're like the kings of that. They work so fucking hard. Those guys don't stop.
They deal Yeah, they slowed down a little bit, but what am I talking about? They did like a book. Fat Mike did a musical. They've done all kinds of shit. I just mean touring wise, they've definitely slowed down a little bit. But yeah, they're still working on all these projects. But back to your live thing. NOFX used to actually have songs that weren't on records that they would play live, and people like they had a song about George Bush called "Idiot Son of an Asshole," and they would only play that at shows. It's not recorded, but yet everybody knew that song. Like everyone would sing it.
That's amazing to have
that exist. You know, I mean, that would be such a crazy thing to try to do, to play a song only live and not record it, and then, you know, have fans. I mean, I guess it would get bootlegged nowadays on YouTube and everything anyway. So it wouldn't be the same thing. But I always thought that was cool. You know, and it speaks to your point of how a song can be transformed and can, you know, take on a different meaning. That's really, really cool.
Well, you got to give it a shot. You know, it's like you got to go out and tour it. You got to you can't let it die the day the music video comes out on Twitter. You know what I mean? Like that's my attitude. And that's the thing with the record. It's like why, you know, I like thinking about, you know, every aspect of the band, whether it's, you know, album art or music video or something to tweet or whatever, because it all feeds back to the nucleus, which is the songs and, you know, and making the most of those songs and making them live for as long as possible.
Absolutely, man. Well, your first time on the show, I would love to start at the beginning and hear just kind of how you got into, you know, becoming a musician, you know, what your early life was like and kind of what has led you to being frontman of the acclaimed Canadian group, the Arkells. So let's take it from the beginning. You said you grew up in Toronto?
Yeah, so...
Which part exactly?
Downtown, like right near Kensington Market. So I grew up right in the heart of the city.
And crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how interesting my personal story is. I know there's other dudes out there that I think have lived a lot more compelling lives. But I'm really happy about where I came from. And my dad's actually from New York City, but went to university in downtown Detroit. And then went to social work school.
Like Wayne State or something?
Wayne State. Hey, there. How do you know Wayne State?
I just know a lot of stuff.
Okay.
No, I used to date a girl that works at Carmanas Cancer Institute, which is part of Wayne State. And and she lived actually right there on Willis.
Okay.
Right,
awesome.
Right by Wayne State. And yeah, she lived there for a while and then somebody got shot on her doorstep and she had to move. So anyways, yeah, you know, Detroit. But yeah, no, I know Wayne State is pretty much the only, like, you know, main university in downtown Detroit that I'm aware of. So I took a guess and I nailed it.
You nailed it. So he was there in the 60s and had his own show, like a campus radio show. Oh, are you there? Oh.
Hello?
Oh, did I lose you there for a second?
No, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. I'll start. You can cut this.
No, I leave it in.
Okay. So he started, he was a campus DJ at Wayne State University and he'd get like records like a couple weeks before they came out. And so as a result, he had all the, like Sgt. Pepper's like the 2 weeks before it came out and he trucked around these records for the next 20 years until I was born. And, I grew up with a lot of those records in the house and my earliest memories of playing music, were with my dad. He'd play like, you know, a Beatles song, like Got to Hide Your Love Away. And I had a little kid guitar and I was obsessed with the Beatles. The first movie I ever watched was Help. And when I was in kindergarten, I'd bring in like Abbey Road into school and there's a record player in my kindergarten class for some reason. And I'd listen to that during playtime. So I was very obsessed with the Beatles from a very young age. And the Beatles and Motown music was basically like all I listened to until about grade 7. So that really informed the way I think about songwriting. And yeah, just as that sort of like sense of like musicality, like those Motown and Beatles are sort of like the holy grail for me.
When did you get like your first guitar?
I got it probably when I was like 10 or something, but I didn't really touch it. I started playing guitar in high school, like in grade 11. I took piano lessons as a kid, but I was actually really into sports. So I played a lot of baseball and basketball, like baseball at Christie Pitts in downtown Toronto. That was like the home field.
And sure.
I love basketball, but yeah, definitely in high school, I transitioned and started dating a girl, and she was really into, like, it would have been 2002. I was in grade 11, 2003. So she was like really into Simple Plan and Sum 41. It was like the height of like pop punk.
Sure.
And like a lot of guitar based music. And so that had me picking up a guitar. And I went back and learned a bunch of Beatles songs and then a bunch of, you know, Sum 41 and Blink 182. Songs and I started playing with dudes in my high school and the talent show, and I really had the bug, and I decided that I want to expand my like musical community, and I figured if I went away to university, I'd get to meet a bunch of people from not necessarily my neighborhood. So I ended up going to McMaster, and from there that's where I met Mike and Nick, who are in the band today, like on the first and second day of school. So I was really lucky to find those guys immediately.
Yeah, it's really cool. So when you were in high school, you were just kind of playing guitar, like, you know, working on your craft. Were you playing in bands?
Yeah, actually my neighbor across the street, two brothers, one was older, one was younger, and Alex played guitar, Eli played drums, and their mom was nice enough to let us like set up in their basement and jam. So there's definitely some like old videos, I could probably track one down and send it to, of us jamming in their basement. And like, you know, everything from like Jimi Hendrix to the Beatles to Weezer, Sweater Song. Actually, we played a talent show at their high school. They went to another high school. And it was a two-song set. We opened with Sweater Song, and we were all wearing sweaters, obviously. And then we took off the sweaters to reveal yellow t-shirts, and we played Yellow by Coldplay, which was a big song.
You didn't pull the thread as I walk away to take the hood?
That would have been the best costume change ever. Ah, shit, yeah.
Yellow by Coldplay. You really wore yellow shirts when you played Yellow by Coldplay?
Yeah. Wow, I was into the wardrobe changes back then, I guess.
that's super funny. Well, it's funny, you know, like a lot of our listeners, most of them are American. Your country.
Actually,
fucked.
One of
your
the
country's
stuff,
fucked. Sorry. Sorry. What were you saying? Go ahead.
Somebody came to a show recently because they heard Frank on your podcast talk about us.
Crazy.
I forget what show it was, but no, you know, it was Nashville. Somebody came to the Nashville show. So shout out to the dude who I met at the Nashville show who heard about it through your podcast. So thank you.
No, it's wild, man. The people that listen to this shit are like super into it, and like they really care, and they're very much looking for new music and different music. And whenever I'm talking to like a buddy or someone in a band, I'm like, you know, you spend an hour of your day and talk to me, you're probably going to have a good time doing my show, and you're going to get something out of it. Like, this isn't something just throw away. Like, I guarantee you people are going to check out your band because of this, you know, and it really is worthwhile. I don't know what it is, if it's partly to do with the long format of a podcast, if it just happens to be the fans of the show. I don't know what it is, but I'm really proud of that.
I love that. First of all, I think the long form conversations with a host that you trust.
Yeah.
It makes such a difference. But doesn't it blow your mind that there's somebody, that there's like random kids out there that are like in Nashville, like listening to this? Like, I always like, that's still, the novelty of that still is exciting to me. I don't know. Like, I don't, like, I know it probably goes away over time or the more successful you get, but there's still a part of me that's like, oh, that's so great. That's so cool.
you know, it's really cool. I think, you know, and I started this, All Access Club, it's called, which is like basically like a kind of like a VIP program where people can contribute some money each month and they get some perks and stuff. So now we're all on a Facebook group together and we're all on there chatting. And it's really cool because, yeah, you mentioned there's somebody from Nashville. Well, there's people from New Zealand and Australia and Germany and the UK. And then there's people from Texas and people from Minnesota and people from South Carolina, like people from all these different cultures somehow are coming together, you know, to listen to this show and me talk about pretty much about music, but really we talk about everything. And yet somehow all those people get so much out of it that they're willing to, you know, pay their hard earned money to be a part of this thing, which is really, really cool because, you know, let's face it, you've traveled the world, like, you know how different places and cultures and people can be.
So, but you know, I think that I totally agree. But, and I also think that's one of the things I admire about, like, sort of like the punk community, is that there are people that share that interest and that feeling that like punk music offers all around the world. So you could be from Nashville, you could be from Singapore, you could be from Berlin, but there's like a common feeling that the scene that like you're a part of represents, which I think is a beautiful thing. That's a very unifying thing to me. And like our music is a little more like pop, like that's more of a pop bent to it. Like, or just a populist, like, what am I trying to say? It's definitely not like quite as like niche-y as punk, if you want to call punk a niche, which is not quite, but, and so I don't know if you get that kind of personality in an Arkells listener that sense of community in every different place, because there's like maybe, I don't know, an Arkells equivalent in Germany, but I really love
your band is really hard to figure out like that.
Cause we're a tweener band. Like the problem is that like we have so many different influences and we sort of land somewhere in the middle. So, but it's anyway, I really love how you can go around the world and there's like a punk scene, that embody a similar spirit.
Yeah. No, it
you
is,
know,
it
in
is.
Every continent.
Absolutely. It is really cool. Okay. So back to Kensington, growing up in Kensington Market, which for a lot of the American, listeners, they're not really understand what that is. Now it's right in downtown Toronto, and it's kind of like this sort of weird, like kind of very hippie, very like, you know, left, little, I don't know, couple blocks.
Yeah.
And
it's like,
it's kind of strange.
It is.
For you to grow up there. That must have been, that's unique. Like you say, oh, my story is not that interesting. That's such a weird place to grow up. And not only that, but like most of the people I interview are from like Ohio and they grew up in the suburbs where like, you know, they're driving to a Guitar Center in their mom's minivan to get their first guitar. And then they, you know what I mean? And they have like a, you know what I mean? Like that kind of a thing.
Totally.
Whereas you're like in the city. Like I'm surprised you were even able to play music in a basement in Kensington Market. Do you know what I mean? Like it's way harder when you're in downtown Toronto to do it, you know?
Yeah, well, a couple things. Like, so Kensington Market, there's like little like grocery shops and there's vintage stores and there's like the cannabis store and there's like a vintage guitar place. It's really like
Paul's
eclectic.
Boutique.
Paul's Boutique, yeah. I used to go in there and bug Paul like once a week. God bless Paul, nice guy. It's right next to Chinatown, and the area, it's when I was growing up especially, it's sort of kind of in between Chinatown and like Little Italy and Little Portugal. So there's actually not that many like straight up like middle class white people there. Now there's a lot more because like the area has gotten a little bit more expensive and generally more gentrified. But 20 years ago when I was growing up, like I was actually looking at a photo from my grade 8 graduation, and like I was like out of, I don't know, 250 kids, I was like maybe one of like 17 white kids.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of Asians that went to our school. And anyway, one, I think it made me sort of just appreciate like the differences in, you know, different people and like the struggles that people have in their lives. And like the fact that most of those kids were like first generation Canadians and their parents worked their ass off to come to Toronto and to try to start like a great life for their family. Number one. And number two, and I think this also applied to my high school experience, is that I know most like traditional like American high schools, when it comes to like white suburban high schools, like there is this real hierarchy that exists and cliques and a social order that is a very stressful thing for a lot of, I think, teenagers to go through.
Absolutely.
But and I think that's where like a lot of like good punk music probably stems from originally, because like maybe you're one of the outcasts and you like need to just go into your garage and plug in your guitar and scream your face off, which I think is very cathartic. And I think there's definitely like a narrative that exists for a lot of punk bands that have started in suburban garages, which makes so much sense to me. But for me, because there's so many different racial backgrounds in my school, nobody really gave a shit about what the other people were doing. Like it wasn't like, oh, there's the pretty white girl who's that like pretty white blonde girl who's like at the top of the totem pole. Everyone's like, I don't give a shit. And it was very healthy, I think. I think people just sort of like living side by side and not really worrying about like kind of stupid North American conventions when it comes to like the high school experience actually I think was a very good experience for me to have because I never really had that like sense of like social loneliness or pressure that I think a lot of other like white kids, middle-class white kids get.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me. And I
know it's unusual,
I mean,
but
here's the funny part is I'm 30 minutes from you in Oakville going to high school and like, you know, there's probably 17. Well, no, we had quite a few Asian and Indian people and stuff, but mostly white. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I mostly went to a white high school, and I'd say we did have that, you know, you talk about the white girl beauty queen totem pole. We did have that. Absolutely.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, and I know friends, yeah, who went to schools like in a different area of the city, and they totally had that. But just my particular high school,
yeah,
being where it was, in between Little Italy, Chinatown, Kensington Market. It's like no one. I just think that everybody like kind of minded their own business and got along. It's kind of nice.
It's funny because most people would think, oh, you're in an inner city school. Like it's going to be more. It's going to be more dangerous, or it's going to be more of those problems. And in fact, it's the opposite, which is crazy. You know what I mean?
No, totally. And don't get me wrong. There definitely are some like inner city schools that are tough and you know have their own set of problems.
Yep.
But. Yeah, but for, like I just found myself in this like nice little like kind of serene place. At least for me, I don't know. I thought it was
great.
I thought it was like a good experience.
So you had a pretty good high school experience overall.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of in my nature too. Like my dad, who's probably like one of my greatest role models, he's like a very I don't know gentle. Sweet guy. Like he was a social worker for many years, and he ran like a group home for teenagers for like 20 years in Toronto, and is like, you know, just like he's really into music, he's really into sports, he's really into like mental health, and he like organizes conferences now. And
That's awesome.
Yeah, he's a very sort of like present kind of guy. I definitely take from his personality, and I feel I'm lucky, I think, in that regard, because I know some people are born into tough situations or inherit characteristics from their parents that like make life a little bit harder, say. But definitely, like if I like to think I have a pretty sunny disposition, and I definitely I think you know I was lucky when it comes to inheriting that from my dad.
Absolutely. So back to the band. So you know, you say you went to college in Hamilton, which for the listeners, it's about an hour maybe from Toronto.
Yeah.
You say you met the guys on the first day, and you started a band, a serious band. But it must have also been kind of weird because you're starting out something in college where you're trying to, you know, get an education. You're trying to obviously have to pay attention in class and everything. But then all of a sudden you have a distraction right away, which is a band. Like how serious was the band right away? Or was it just kind of for fun? And then it kind of morphed into something more serious.
I think we all took it seriously in the way that young people take things seriously if they're excited about it. Do you know what I mean? Like when you're young, it's pretty easy to get like wrapped up into something. And like really want to do a good job, and you're living and breathing it. But that said, we were very like realistic with like the chances of it ever becoming anything. So I think everybody had like a bit of a backup plan, and you know, Mike and Nick are really smart guys, and they're kind of like academic types, to be honest. Like I'm not so much. Like I can kind of get by my in school with like with nothing more than a B+, but normally like a C+, B- kind of guy, like without trying particularly hard or giving a shit. But those guys could have gone to grad school and that would have suited them, I think, just fine. But we all loved playing in the band, and we'd gig like every weekend. We'd go to St. Catharines, go to Guelph. We took like the Greyhound to London, Ontario, which is like a couple hours away from Hamilton, just to play a gig. We took the Go Bus into Toronto to play the Silver Dollar. So we definitely like
with all your gear, like you brought your gear on the Greyhound bus?
Yeah, we put a bunch of stuff underneath the Go Bus, like, you know, in the compartment underneath.
That's crazy. You're touring on a bus, so you're still a local band.
Yeah, exactly. We are already a bus band, man. That's right. That's funny, actually. So But the timing worked out so well. So we like played in the Battle of the Bands, like in our first year, and we came in second. We lost to like an awesome, hilarious ska band called the Johnstones. Do you know those guys?
I do know them. Yeah.
Yeah. At the time they're like the rage, and they're like to put on the craziest shows. And we were just sort of like watching with our mouths on the floor. Just like, what is going on? But it was very like, it was actually like a good lesson in showmanship, I'd say. But, we carried on and we played as much as we could. And I remember like in third year, like we're like, all right, we need to make an EP, and like, you know, have something, you know, to sell that we're proud of. And we went out to Scarborough over a couple of days to record it, but drove back at midnight every night. And I would write essays from like midnight to 8 a.m., hand it in, and then go back to Scarborough. So it was like one of those things I look back on going, Jesus Christ, like what a dumb, like, I don't know if I do that today. That just seems like insane to me. Like, but when you're young and you're taking things seriously and you're really passionate about it, you'll do crazy shit, as you know. Like, yeah. I'm sure you've done crazy things.
I have similar stories of when I was, because I went to University of Guelph, and it was the same thing. The band was starting to happen. And and I had to make, I couldn't make a choice. I you know what I mean? I couldn't just do the band because that was stupid. It's like, well, it's a band. Like, it's never going to work out. But then if I was to just do school and quit the band, then it wouldn't be like, you know, it wouldn't be my passion. So it sounds like you run through exactly the same thing at this point.
Exactly, exactly. So where we got really fucking lucky is that in, I want to say about, so, okay, in the summer going into fourth year university, so this would have been 2007,
yep,
we played North by Northeast, which is a cool kind of indie music festival in Toronto for your listeners. And we were on like the 1 o'clock in the afternoon spot at Yonge and Dundas Square, which is like the big open air square right in downtown Toronto. It was a pretty unremarkable set as far as I can remember. There weren't many people there. We didn't think anything of it. But a fellow named Sean Creamer, who's the owner of the Dakota Tavern, which is like one of the coolest music hangouts in Toronto, which is, has like
very
live
cool
music
right on
seven
Ossington.
Nights a week, right on Ossington. It's like capacity 75. He happened to be walking by and he happened to like what he heard and decided to buy like all of our EPs. Like I think we went to the merch table and we're like, did we really sell everything? The merch girl was like, yeah, you sold all of them. So we felt good about that. We didn't know that this one guy had bought all of them.
Weird. Okay.
Yeah. And then what he had done in the following couple months is just handed them out to music people in the industry that were hanging around at his bar. So
this is without telling you or talking to
Without even telling us, just without even, just as a good deed, just because he liked what he heard. He must have listened to the EP at home. This is the EP we would have like recorded probably in Scarborough. And Joel Carrier got his hands on it. And Joel is like the mastermind behind Alexis on Fire and Dallas Green, City in Color.
Dynalone Records.
Dynalone Records. Yeah. So are you with New Damage, by the way?
Yes, we are.
Oh, there you go.
I was just hanging out with Joel. I was hanging out with Joel 2 days ago. We were watching Monin together, rocking out.
Oh, at Least Palace for the reunion shows. It was a full blast. That's crazy.
Right.
Oh,
yep.
Man. How were those shows, by the way?
I went to the one on Wednesday, and I'm going tonight.
Oh, fucking
and
right.
Alexis on Fire is playing tonight. So,
are you kidding me?
Yeah, no, they're playing.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's like a secret set. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I almost want to go now.
Go. Fuck, go. I'm sure you can find a way in.
Oh, yeah.
If I had a plus, I don't even have a plus one. If I had a plus one, I'd take you, but
oh shit, that sounds amazing. Okay,
fuck, you finagle your way in. If you can, I heard you snuck into a NCAA basketball game once. So if you can do that, you can definitely.
Oh,
I do my research, dude. If you can do that, you can definitely sneak into fucking Lee's Palace. I'll just open the back door for you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, so Joel ended up hearing the EP because Sean Creamer that gave it to him at the Dakota and emailed us on MySpace, messaged us on MySpace. It was like, hey, heard your song on the way to work today. Fucking love it. Let's try to connect. And then we ended up playing a show a couple months later at the Dakota and Joel came to the show. And like from that night, we started working with them and we told them that we were about 3 months away from graduating because it was probably like December, January. So we said, hey, just give us till like March, April, and then we're all yours. And so we made our moms happy and we graduated with like a four-year degree. And then from there, we just started touring and we've sort of been touring ever since. And the reason why I say it's really lucky is because a lot of bands, a lot of people who are really interested in music, finish their college degree and then spend this, like, you know, that age, like 21 to 24, sort of puttering around, not sure what to do. Their parents are putting pressure on them to find a real job and you're working at a, you know, restaurant or whatever. But for us, the fact that we kind of got to get right on the saddle and like just go for it made our lives a lot easier because we just had momentum from the get go, which I'm very aware of how fortunate that is. Cause that's, I think, somewhat unusual.
No, it's cool. I love the story. And again, it's almost the same as my story, except I was in Guelph. And it was Victory Records that called, and I was just at the end of my second year. So that was a harder decision for me because, because I had to drop out. So I never finished my degree. I did about 2.5 years, and I dropped out. So that, you know, when you say make your mom's happy, my parents were a little like, I mean, they watched me play music, you know, my whole life, and every time I ever had a birthday or Christmas present, it was like a new piece of gear or something I wanted. Do you know what I mean? That kind of thing. Music was my life, so they weren't going to take it away from me. But at the same time, they were like, so you're going to drop out of school and tour in a van, you know? And I'm like, yep. And they were like, all right, we're not going to tell you not to. So it was a much, much harder thing. So in some ways, you're lucky that it happened when it did. If it happened a year before, who knows if everybody in your band would have been on board.
Well, this is the thing. I totally, that's why we're so lucky. And, you know, well, first of all is well that ends well with you and Silverstein.
Sure.
You know, you made
and
a life
too.
Out of it.
And you too.
And that's great. But I'll tell you this. So my dad, and my mom was the one who was apprehensive. My dad sort of like, you know, as I said, easygoing and very trustworthy of me and assumed I'd figure it out one way or another. My mom is definitely a more like worried mom type.
Yep.
And when my mom and dad started dating, like back in the late 70s, my dad had a friend named Steve. I forget Steve's last name, but Steve was like a bohemian bum that fancied himself a musician that lived in Kensington Market, but basically lived off his parents' money. Like, he came from a rich family, but pretended to be a musician, never made any money for himself, was just constantly asking his parents for dough. And my mom was like worried, like in her very worried motherly.
That you were going to be that guy.
That I'd be Steve. So for the first few years of the band, she was like very cautious about like, okay, it sounds like it's going okay. Like with a quiver in her voice. Now it's all good. And she trusts everything is fine. But she was very worried that I'd become Steve, which is funny.
That's so funny, man. That's so funny.
One other funny little anecdote about that last half year, like from the end of fourth year, we were called Charlemagne at the time. We haven't always been Arkell. So our original college band name was Charlemagne, which is an equally fucking meaningless, dumb name. But we had gotten a MySpace notice from another Charlemagne who's based in Wisconsin, like threatening to sue us. I'm going to send you a cease and desist letter unless you drop that name.
Right.
And so we're like, oh shit, you know, this guy, he has more MySpace followers than us. We don't want to get sued for our $200 that's in the bank account. And when Joel saw us, he saw us as Charlemagne. And one of the first things he was going to do for us was put a flyer in the New City in Color album that was going to be coming out that year in 2008. So he sent us an email saying, hey, by the way, this thing, we're doing it. Check out this flyer. It looks pretty cool. We're going to press go. Is that cool? So we had to call him and we said, Joel, this is amazing, but we have to change our name. There's something we didn't tell you. There's another Charlemagne. We need to change the name. And he said, oh, okay. What's the new name going to be? This thing's going to the printer in 15 minutes. And so I still remember to this day, I was at the school library, Mills Library at McMaster. And I was like, I'll call you back. And I hung up the phone and frantically called the guys. And I was like, guys, what are we going to do? And we've been putting off the decision. We'd come up with a million bad replacement names. We couldn't come up with anything. And we settled on Arkell's. Because Mike and I lived on Arkell Street, and we thought it sounded like a girl's like 50s doo-wop name, like the Shirelles.
Yeah,
the Mandelas.
It does. Yeah, it does.
And so it kind of had that vibe to it, and so we called him back like 50 minutes later. Arkell's, what do you think? And he's like, okay, works for me. That's it. From that day on, we're the Arkells.
Works for, do you like the band name? Well, nah, works for me.
We have this printer thing set up.
That's such a great story. I love that story so much. That's funny. No, even our band name was one of those. We had a show. We needed a name. It's five dumb guys looking around the room, and I saw Shel Silverstein book on the ground and was like, I don't know, Silverstein, like pointed at it, and everyone's like, okay, and that was it. You know, it's funny. It's funny how like these, you know, these band names just kind of come out of, I don't know,
the band are name story. Jewish?
No, we're not. And that's, but believe me, when we used to go to Spadina Jobbers to get our blank shirts, do you remember that place?
Oh yeah.
And it was run by a Jewish family. They used to like give us the bro deal because I think they thought we were Jewish.
You mean the tribe deal? You're a member of the tribe. That's what the Jews call themselves.
Okay, yeah, I guess so. See, I don't even know that terminology. Jewish,
yeah. Actually, unrelated, and you can cut this if you want. But do you know Aaron Goldstein? Do you know that guy? He's an old. He plays pedal steel. He's like a bearded fella.
I think I know the name. I know the name.
He's an awesome guy. He's like one of my oldest music friends, and he just opened a studio on Baldwin in downtown Toronto.
Yep.
And so he's Aaron Goldstein. His business partner's Abe Levy. So two very Jewish sounding names.
Very, yes.
And their studio is on Baldwin Street in a building owned by Silverstein's Bakery because Silverstein's Bakery owns that whole block and. There's literally a bagel oven in the studio. So it's Levy and Goldstein in Silverstein's Bakery with a fucking bagel oven. How great is that?
That's crazy. Well, you know, the Silverstein Bakery is no more.
I know. They just moved somewhat recently, right?
Which is crazy. And it's funny because like our whole – well, when we started the name, we didn't know about the Silverstein Bakery. But of course, like right after – everyone's like, oh, it's this bakery. It's been around for like 100 years. Everyone knows this bakery. We're like, oh, I don't know. We didn't know. And it's funny how somehow our band, our stupid band, outlasted the bakery. It's like a Toronto tradition. You know,
that is, hey, 16 years, man. That's a long time for any band.
We got to take a quick break to hear about our sponsor, Loot Crate, but we'll be right back with more from me and Max. If you've been listening to the show the last couple months, you're going to know all about this. However, if you're a little behind, like some people tend to get, it's okay. Listen up, because we have a great sponsor that's super supportive of the show, super supportive of me, and they're doing some absolutely rad things. If you're into nerdy stuff, I mean, I'm a geek. It's just who I am. I accept it. If you're into retro video games, if you're into cult movies, if you're level 28 on Pokemon Go like me, if you're into graphic novels, whatever it is, you got to check out Loot Crate. Basically, it's a subscription service. You get this really, really cool box sent to your house every month, and it's like $20. And it's really, really rad. The stuff they send is awesome. I got a couple right here. They do a great job. So, if you're on a quest for epic gear, housewares, and collectibles, Loot Crate brings you between 4 and 6 of the coolest curated mystery items every month straight to your doorstep. It's the best surprise you know is coming. This month's crate theme is Origins. We have awesome and exclusive items from your old school favorites. This January, see where it all started and explore the iconic Origins with historic items featuring Superman, Captain America, Mario, God, I love Mario, and of course, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, including, as always, our monthly t-shirt and pin. Now, here is how it works. You have until the 19th, January 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific, that's midnight Eastern, to subscribe and receive this month's crate. And when that cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. No more Origins for you. So make sure you get on that. We're getting to that point. We got a couple days, but make sure you sign up. So head over to lootcrate.com/leadsinger and enter the promo code leadsinger to save $3 off any new subscription today. So again, that's lootcrate.com/leadsinger. Enter promo code lead singer, and it's coming straight to you, and it's awesome. We haven't talked a lot about singing, and this is the Lead Singer Syndrome podcast. And I want to ask you a little bit about your voice, because you have kind of a unique style, and it's sort of like you are kind of going more for, and I'm totally guessing, and I could be wrong, it's almost like you're kind of going for a vibe of in terms of your voice, rather than just trying to be this fucking belting out shredder of a singer. Do you know what I mean? Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I wish. Here's what I'd say: is that I'm definitely technically not a good singer, like in terms of like real crooners or guys that have like really powerful pipes. I don't think I put myself in that category. So what I've always relied on is this idea that people just like an original voice. So like an original voice is in many ways more important than being technically a good singer. Like Bob Dylan isn't technically a good singer, but he's unique and it's uniquely him singing. So, I used to be kind of insecure, you know, especially in the early days, very insecure about the sound of my voice. Cause I was like, it didn't sound as good in playback as it did in my head. And I'm like, oh God, is that how I actually sound?
Right.
But over time, you know, I realized that there are many other ingredients that go into how people perceive your voice as compared to just the singular sound of your voice. A lot of it has to do with what you're saying, the kind of music it's matched up with, the sort of swagger you can put into it. And, you know, and so for me, that's like, I don't fret too much about the fact that like, I'm not necessarily the best singer, but if you own it, if you own what you're doing, especially in the business of rock and roll, you can get by.
Absolutely. But it's almost like, I just feel like you're such a vibe singer. And like, even when you're like your live show too. And now we talked a little bit about your live shows, earlier, and I think people need to see your band live to get it.
Totally.
And there's something about it where you're like, you're like up there and you're like cool, but at the same time you're just being honest, like you don't give a fuck, but then you care about what you're saying. And it's like this sort of like I care and I don't care at the same time, to where it's just like honest and it works. And I feel like singing wise, you're going to give the people watching you what they need. Is that ever something you think about? Like it's like, I want all these people in here to leave with what they needed, with what they came for. And I feel like that's what you're trying to deliver.
Yeah, totally. Well, I definitely think that, you know what? I heard an interesting thing in another podcast, actually, about interviewing. But I think it applies to a live show in a certain degree. It's like, this podcast host, his name's Ezra Klein, he said that if you're kind of jovial and easygoing with a guest, that's what they'll give back to you. If you're serious with a guest, they'll be serious back. If you ask short, curt questions, they'll give you short, curt answers. So I think with our live show, I want to convey a sense of like fun, a passion of community. I want it to be inclusive. I want people to dance. And so I think it's up to me to set the tone. So in the first couple songs, especially if you're playing to maybe a new crowd, people don't know exactly what protocol is yet because they've never seen you. But so it's up to you to go, okay, during this set, we're going to sing, we're going to dance, we're going to be earnest, we're going to give a shit, but we're also going to have a sense of humor, we're going to have fun.
Yep.
And those are all elements of who I am and what's in the songs. So it's up to me to be like the conductor on a certain level. That's my main job.
Yeah, like I like my, that. My conductor is a good term for it. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think like, so as a singer, I think I try to inject like all those sensibilities into my performance, especially live, because that's what I want back. And now the coolest thing is that for me, we've built up a rapport with our audience, as you guys have with your audience, where it's like you don't even need to instruct them anymore. Like it's not as hard as it used to be, because you're going to go, and then it gives you more freedom to be even crazier. People who have been to, you know, 30 Arkell shows, like, no, you know, we're going to give a shit. We're going to be good to each other. We're going to sing our hearts out. We're going to dance. And that's like so fun to have like developed that relationship with the audience, but that comes from us leading the charge, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And lyrically, you know, you write a lot of great lyrics, and I feel like that's one thing that you do, better than most of the other mainstream, you know, radio bands or whatever. And I know you're a big, like, Hold Steady fan,
totally.
You know, and you take a lot of influence from, you know, storytellers and stuff like that. I want to ask you one specific thing. I mean, obviously, your big song, Private Schools.
Yeah.
You had to change the words, right, for radio? Because because there's a well, fuck off is the, the main line in the chorus. Now, I got to ask you, because obviously lyrics are important to you, but obviously there's the success of the band and the whole thing. And anytime there's a radio edit, and I've talked to some other people on the show about it, I always want to know what the process was. Like, you know, you write a song. When does the conversation come? Is it like with the band? Is it with the label? Is it when you guys actually go for radio? Like, when does that happen when you're like, fuck, you have to change this?
That's a good question.
Lyric.
Well, we never know what song the label is going to choose as a single. So so if there's a swear word in there or whatever, we don't really think too hard about it, because there's a good chance it won't be a single. But once it got to the point with Private School that would be the single, like the lead single, and the main lyric in the chorus is "Ah, fuck off."
Yeah.
We weren't too precious about it. I understand when some acts are, but like I personally, like I take the songs really seriously. I take songwriting really seriously. It's like the thing that keeps me up at night. But I don't take everything so seriously. It's like so if some label that we're working with is really excited about a song like Private School and is going to, you know, commit their time and some of their money to try to make it a successful song on the radio, then I think I'd like to play ball with them. Like I'm not so serious where I'm going to go, no, you can't compromise my art. This is like this is not like geopolitics or something. It's a fucking rock and roll song. So if they're really excited about this song and think it has potential, and I have to change the lyrics from fuck off to come on, and it stays as fuck off on the album version,
yeah,
then whatever, that's fine with me. I'm not overly precious, but I know what you're saying, because I'm always curious about that conversation when you hear radio edits. And there's a song by The Weeknd that's on the radio right now. It's like, and the lyric is, I'm a motherfucking star boy. Have you heard the radio edit?
I haven't heard
it.
No, I love The Weeknd.
So the radio edit is, he goes, I'm a star boy. So they just
right.
I'm a.
but you know what the thing is like, you say, oh, well, I don't know what song's gonna be the single or whatever. But like, does that mean you went back in the studio and re-recorded that line, or did you have the foresight to do it while you were still?
No, we had to go re-record it. We did that song in LA, and I had to go bang up the chorus. It was easy enough. Like the guy Brian West, who produced the track, really nice guy. I just popped by. It literally took like an hour.
It's just, it's funny. Yeah, you like go through actual work. To you know what I mean? To compromise your art. You know?
Yeah.
It's just like a funny thing. And I wonder, like, yeah, The Weeknd probably was like, oh, what do I have to do? Yeah, whatever. I'm
totally.
That's so funny.
And it probably happens more often than you think. Yeah. But we definitely had some conversations about, like, okay, is it I forgot, or instead of I fuck off? Like, I was like, oh, that doesn't really make sense. Like, we had gotten to the point where we were like very happy with the song. The heart and soul of the song was still intact. And if we have to change the lyric, and actually, you know, it's become a live bit in the song where, like, at the show, go before the last chorus and like in the breakdown, I'll go, look, on the radio, you might know it as "Ah, come on," but amongst friends, when I'm at a party with friends,
I go,
"Ah, fuck off." And you know, that's another thing. Like, doors open for you in this business in very strange and unusual and special ways sometimes. So it's like the fact that we had to make that radio edit gave me a live bit, which is cool, which I think is awesome. Sure. That's the way I at least choose to look at it.
Yeah, and you're addressing it so that anybody that heard the song on the radio and now, you know what I mean? You're like, you're saying it is what it is, you know? And
I
respect that a lot. All right, man. Well, I don't want to keep too much more of your time. I do want to talk a little bit of Raptors basketball, because I know you're a big fan. And I'm a huge fan myself. And what do you think's going to happen with the team? Are they getting new players? Can they actually beat Cleveland? What do you think's going to happen?
Well, the short of it is, I don't think we can beat Cleveland with our current roster. I'm really excited with the way DeRozan's played this year, and Lowry.
Yeah, you were
is
a bit critical of DeRozan.
I was critical.
I know you were quite critical.
Yeah, DeRozan, just something about his game has never really pleased my eyes. I don't know. It's like,
well,
I
hey,
love
when you're taking like a 19-foot 2-point shot, it's like, can't you just step a few feet further back and make it worth an extra 50% points? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and his handle wasn't great. He's gotten a little better, but he'd lose the ball. Like, he never seemed to be the most, like, savvy passer. Like, you know, there's guys like James Harden or, like, Dwayne Wade, who just, like, have such good court sense. Yeah. And DeRozan never struck me as that kind of guy either. So, but he's really improved this year. Kyle's really good.
Yeah.
But I don't think anything really changes unless we get like Millsap or like a really another premier guy. In the starting lineup.
I always said we're one player away.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and then what, the Cavs went out and got Kyle Korver.
I know.
Like,
geez,
fuck
that's
off.
Crazy.
Ah,
from
fuck
Mike
off.
Dunleavy? Are you fucking kidding? That's crazy. But you know what? As somebody who is finding like the Warriors almost to be boring at this point because they're so fucking good.
Yeah.
I'm really glad the Cavs got another shooter because I think it'll make that series a little more interesting. Because I mean, I'm
Jeez,
assuming
you're already calling the NBA championship. I mean, there's some other teams out there that could
Who
pull
do you
it
like?
Off. Well, I always like San Antonio. I
mean,
you watch
you
them
never
just
count them
like
out.
they took the Raptors to school the other day. Like that was oh my god, that was ugly.
I know. It was
you,
totally.
You know,
like,
the Raptors had 8 assists in that whole ball game.
Oh god, I did not know it was that.
How
few.
Is that even? Is that a record? 8 assists? That's fucked. I can't even believe it. But hey, man, I'm a big sports guy, and I know you are too. And
I'm actually going to the Leafs game tomorrow. I'm kind of getting. I am
also
really grew up
going
hockey.
To the Leafs game tomorrow.
Oh shit! Let's get a beer.
I'll text
that's awesome.
You. Yeah, we'll meet in between an intermission. Absolutely.
Oh, that's
let's get
awesome.
A beer. Yeah. That's awesome, dude. Very crazy, man. Well, hey, dude, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're a busy guy, always working. So what's next for Arkell? So tell the people.
We are going on tour with Frank Turner across North America. So you should come to the show. We're doing starting Jan 19th in D.C. And then like Philly and then kind of across through Cincinnati, Chicago, Denver, Phoenix, up the West Coast. And then we're opening for Frank, and like Murder by Death is on that run. And
I love Murder by Death, man.
I know, and John K. Samson's on some of the dates.
Really?
It's like a pretty stacked bill from the Weaker
Than. That's
Dance.
So cool.
And then it flips, and Frank's opening for us across Canada.
Yeah.
So we're going to be doing
any American listeners, any American listeners listening to this, go find Max and tell him that you heard about his band on the podcast, and now you're a huge fan. Okay, go tell him.
I would love that. Hey, are you around Feb 10th? Because we're playing Hamilton. You should come.
Absolutely. 100%.
Okay.
I'll be
consider
there.
Yourself on the guest list. It's it's going to be good.
Would love it. Dude, amazing. Well, thank you so much for doing this. And man, all the best.
Thank you. This was really fun. I really love this. This is great.
So there it is with Max. Awesome dude. Make sure you check out the Arkells on tour with Frank Turner. Like I said in the interview, you've got to see them live to really, kind of get what they're doing. I think that's really what it's all about with the Arkells. Next week, we'll be back on Monday. As always, make sure you're subscribed. If you like the show, go on iTunes, write a review, preferably 5 stars. All that stuff helps. And please, if you like the show, tell a friend. Word of mouth is really what has helped this thing grow. What has helped this thing spread. Also join the All Access Club. Do that too. Thanks again, everybody. I'm going to leave you with a tune. As always, here's the song we mentioned in the podcast. It's called Private Schools. Here it is on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love.
Private school girls, private school boys, playing games, expensive toys. Private school girls, private school boys, Don DeLillo wrote white notes. I tried so hard to find an end, but you weren't giving me anything. Come on now, throw me a line, it's a sign. Skin, the nicest girl. such a chore.